This is a CBC podcast. Know someone who's learning English as an additional language? Be sure to tell them about CBC Manitoba's weekly Learning English podcast. They can download language lessons and learn more about life in Manitoba at cbc.ca/podcasting.
From the Reen M. Case Theatre in Bracebridge, Ontario, it's The Vinyl Cafe with Stuart McLean.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, I met a young woman in town this week. I met her when I came here to this high school to talk to a few of the classes. Her name is Savannah Robinson, and she is 17 years old. And after she'd asked me a few questions about what it is I do, I asked her a few about herself. Savannah told me that she is in grade 12, graduating this year, and if everything goes as planned, heading to university in the fall. This summer, she has a job working at the Windermere Pub, where she is hoping she will make a little more money than she did last summer when she worked at the marina. But it was fun working at the marina last summer, especially because when she went to work the first day, she wore the same blue windbreaker her father, Tony, wore when he worked at the very same marina some 30 summers ago. Summer jobs. I got my first summer job the summer I was 16 years old. I was hired as a counselor at a YMCA day camp. It was a big deal for me. But the highlight of that summer was not at work. It came at the end of every second week when the kids were sent home early, and we were paid cash money in little brown envelopes. My pal Alec Cunningham and I would take our envelopes and our teenage selves down the street to Murray's Family Restaurant. We'd order the very same lunch every time, vanilla shakes and the hamburger royale, which came with cheese and fries and all the fixings. And when they came, the two of us would sit there staring at our burgers like two big-time operators. There's nothing quite like the feeling of having money in your pocket that you've earned yourself. That was the start of it for me that summer at the Y. The next summer, or maybe the summer after that, my father got me a job in the small village of Saint-Tite, Quebec. I had failed grade 11 French. For the second year running. And I think he decided plucking me from my Anglo-Montreal neighborhood and dropping me into the heart of French Quebec would do me good. Or more to the point, perhaps, serve me right. Got me a job working on the roads, working with a crew who were paving the highway that ran alongside the St. Maurice River between Saint-Roch-de-Mackinac and Saint-Jean-des-Piles. When I arrived, I realized, to my horror, that I was the only English-speaking person for miles. I spent an incredibly lonely couple of months there. On the weekends, when the French college boys I was living with went home to Quebec, I hitchhiked some 20 kilometers to Grand-Mère, which was the closest town I knew of where I could buy a Montreal Gazette. One Saturday afternoon, I took the paper into the hotel bar and I sat down at a table smack in the middle of the room. It was livelier in there than you'd expect for a Saturday afternoon, which I put down to the famous French joie de vivre. And trying to get into the spirit, I sprawled my feet up on the extra chair at my table. I flung open my newspaper and I started to read. When I spotted a waiter, I waved him over and asked for a beer, and he gave me one off his tray but wouldn't take my money. Guess you pay when you're finished, I thought, and I kept reading my paper. And it was some time later, much too much later, and only when I saw the bride dance by my table in her bridal gown that I realized what was going on. I'd crashed a wedding. And everyone there was either too polite or too horrified to say anything to me. The next summer, the summer of 1967, was Canada's centennial. The summer the World's Fair, Expo 67, was mounted in my hometown, Montreal. I just finished my first year in university, and as spring approached, all my university friends were busy lining up jobs at the fair. The theme was Man and His World, and my pal Nick decided to take that slogan as a personal challenge. Nick began that summer with a pledge to swing a date with a woman from each of the 60-odd participating countries. Nick, who was nothing if not well-organized when it came to organizing dates, sealed the deal when he triumphantly spent the fair's final night with a flight attendant from Czechoslovakia. While my friends spent that summer embracing the world in Montreal, I, oh, what an idiot, decided that was the summer to head west. I took the train across the country and got myself a construction job in Calgary. On weekends, I would hitchhike to Banff, where, instead of Czechoslovak air hostesses, I spent my nights battling the coyotes in the buffalo paddock on the edge of town. I'd somehow come to the conclusion that the fence around the paddock would keep me safe from the bears. I can't explain what made me think that camping out in what amounted to a cage full of buffalo should be any safer than camping in a forest full of bears, except to say I was young and probably shouldn't have lived to be this old. Certainly not if Darwin was right about anything. I thought it was a pretty good one, too. Saw a little of Expo when I got home at the end of August, though not nearly as much of the fair or the world as my pal Nick. I had a number of other summer jobs over those years. I worked in a bar as a busboy, in a factory assembling ski poles, and in a paint factory stacking boxes of paint onto pallets. But my favorite summer job was my last, which was, in a pleasing sort of symmetry, working once again for the YMCA, which, of course, was where it began for me. In the summer of 1969, I got a job at Camp Kanawana on the shores of Lake Kanawana in the Laurentian Mountains. This is where I found my sea legs. I arrived at camp with a backpack full of fears, but I found myself in a place where I felt, for the first time, that I was as good as everyone else, or where I could contribute to the greater good anyway. And that gave me confidence. And confidence is very important to the growth and development of a young person. Camp was my safe place. And it's only because I found myself there, or my best self there, that I was able to find my heart's desire. CBC Radio. I couldn't have done that. I couldn't have tramped off into the unknown if I hadn't had my summers at camp and no doubt all those other summer jobs. I learned something at all of them. You wouldn't expect that a summer camp or a construction job or a few weeks in a bar or a paint factory would amount to much. But these things add up. And what they add up to is always bigger than you could possibly imagine. So, as another summer takes us in its warm embrace, here's to you, Savannah, and to all of your friends, and to all of their summer jobs. Here's to the summer hotels and the summer camps. Here's to the lifeguards and the counselors. Here's to the chambermaids and the tour guides, to the gardeners' helpers and the landscapers. Here's to the landscape of summer work. Here's to waiters and waitresses, to beginnings and to endings, to hellos and goodbyes, to everyone heading off into the wild blue yonder. I pray that you will learn, as I did, in your summer work, that work is prayer, that God is in the details, and that it is a good life, with so much happiness to be had when you can find it, and that a summer job like a summer love, can be much more than you had ever imagined. Good luck. God bless. This is Craig Cardiff with a song called Safe Here.
Came out all like edges of knives when all we needed was to talk things through. This is a process of learning that love is all. Not what you say, but what you do. I said, this is my country, this is your country too. There are so many things we need to change. It'd be too easy to bat and overwhelm my soul. It'd be too easy to let things stay the same. I said, am I safe here? Yes, you are safe here. Am I needed here? Oh, well, yes, you are needed here. Yes, you are, yes, you are. And then they chiseled on and chiseled and chiseled to everything we loved. And everything we earned was taken away from us. And this is my country, this is your country too. There are so many things we need to change. It would be too easy to battle and overwhelm us on. To let things stay the same, I said, and am I safe here? Oh, yes, you are safe here. Am I needed here? Oh, yes, you are needed here. Yes, you are. Yes, you are.
Craig Cardiff And that wonderful song is called Safe Here. That has not been recorded yet, but we will let you know as soon as it has been. Time now for the Vinyl Cafe Story Exchange. Well, you know how this part works. This is the part of the show where you send us your stories. They have to be true stories and they have to be short stories, but after that, well, after that, it's up to you. We promise we'll read everything you send us and we'll read some of our favorites on the radio show. If we read your story, we'll send you a copy of the latest Vinyl Cafe book. We have one today from Margaret Fry of Richmond, British Columbia. Dear Stuart, writes Margaret, the story begins when I started working at a Safeway grocery store in Richmond. I worked in the deli there for many years, and over those years I became friends with a sandy-haired customer. He always arrived on Saturday mornings with a list an arm long, but he moved quickly and was in and out of the store before you knew it, whistling classical music and going his merry way. With my name tag, he knew my name, but I never got to know his. Over the years, we started chatting. He'd stop at my deli counter each week, and I learned that he worked for CP Air and had a family of five that lived just around the corner. Our over-the-counter chit-chat became a ritual. We had some good laughs together. He called me his bologna salami Saturday psychiatrist. Can't remember how the idea of a picnic came about, but somehow it did. Every week we would make plans, pretend dates, to meet at places like Gary Point Park. The deal was that I would bring the bologna and he would bring the homemade wine. It was all in jest, of course, but it was fun. Each Saturday morning, we'd talk about why we had each forgotten to show up. Sometimes his wife would come with him to the store, and she and I would have a good laugh about her husband and me never making it to our picnic date. Years went by, and every week we played this game. Once I told him I wouldn't sell him a barbecue chicken because I felt he wasn't responsible enough to look after a dead bird. He agreed. We both must have been about the same age, around 55, when I noticed with concern his step had become slower. He had lost weight, and he rarely whistled anymore. I wanted to ask him, but I knew that wouldn't be right. He was a customer. Slowly, his wife started to shop more often, and I felt a cloud hanging over both of them. One day, she came in, and she was crying. After serving her at the deli, I asked my manager if I could take my break, and I walked with the man's wife out to the parking lot. She told me that my never-to-have-a-picnic friend was in hospital, dying. We hugged and cried. Then she looked at me and she said, "You guys never made it to the picnic." And right then and there, without thinking, I asked her if I could make up a picnic basket for the three of us and bring it to the hospital. She agreed. I packed soda crackers, yogurt, and a banana, and she told me that those were the only things that he could swallow. From her husband's chit-chat, I knew her favorite sandwich was Italian salami with Swiss cheese and a Kaiser bun. We had wine for the ladies, candles, and a red and white checkered tablecloth. The nurse was kind enough to close the divider curtains. We had a window looking out on the park, and we laughed and we cried together. They told me about their children and their life struggles. After 25 years, we finally got our long overdue picnic. My customer grew tired quickly, so our time together was short. His sandy hair was gone, and that fast-moving body was almost lifeless. We said our goodbyes, and I knew as I did I would never see him again. He fought hard, but a few weeks later he could fight no longer. I did one more thing for him. I made the sandwich trays for his funeral. And as I did, I remembered all the times we had spent together over the counter. It didn't matter that I never knew his name. We knew each other, and that was what was important. The story came to us from Margaret Fry of Richmond, British Columbia. This is Craig Cardiff.
My story about a job is going out and playing at the Old English Parlor in Waterloo, Ontario, and thinking I was the cat's meow because I made $20 a night and got all the beer that I could handle. And my mom would come and sit in the back and offer critiques. And a few times she showed up, she was wearing her beige overcoat that she always wore, and she had her pajamas on underneath. Like, Mom, what are you doing? She's like, it's late. So this is a song that she always asked for, and then she'd usually leave after that. She's like, sing me the song you wrote after I told you the story about the woman outside of Brantford when I was growing up. It's a song called Dance Me Outside that we'd like to give to you now.
This Indian girl walks out into traffic. Traffic stops and
she's causing havoc. And baby, won't you roll up the windows and dial up on the cell phone? Get the cops to get out here. I just want to get home. And she says, but do you remember in Buffalo? And the dumb white people say, Jimmy Neil Young, Springfield. But she says, no, but Cleveland, they know. Indians, and not even Eskimos. It feels like you just don't want to know. But she says, take me around, dance me outside, show me a place where he might hide. What I want, I'm afraid that you can't afford to buy. This Indian girl, it's spinning like a toy top, and her hair spreads out like fire, and it's like she just can't stop. And then the cops come, a donor guard, a state car, rolling up along the side with fire lanterns burning, the sirens open wide. And excuse me, little miss, I'm afraid it's time to take this home. And they try to get her a dress. She says, sorry, I don't got none. It's only me in these feeding fields. And look where you are. And she kicks up the hem of her skirt and on go the cars. And she says, take me around, dance me outside, show me a place or in my head. And oh, what a one, I'm afraid that you can't. This Indian girl, feeling cold and tired, wouldn't mind some help then. And the cars go by, and it's no wonder why. Cause all they wanna do is get away from here. But all I wanna do, she says, is get away. And so she belts a fire all through her belly and through her hair and bone, to remind her that she's alive, that she said it all. And she says, take me around, dance me outside, show me a place where he might hide. And what I want, I'm afraid that you can't. Dance me outside, show me a place where he might hide. And what I want, I'm afraid that you have. Take me around, dance me outside, show me a place where he might hide. Said Bruce Donnelly says, everything will be okay, everything will be okay, everything will be okay, everything will be okay, everything will be okay.
That was Craig Cardiff, and that was off his album Good Night, Go Home, and Craig will be back later. It had been a long time coming. It had been coming for years. Morley knew it. Started with a car. Helen had that accident. How long ago was that? That must have been 10 years ago. Helen kept driving for a while, but she had stopped driving, thank God. And then she fell last winter, or was it the winter before? And now it was hard to put your finger on it. It's not like there was some big change. It was just Morley had to face it. Her mother was old. It had been a long time coming, but it seemed to happen all at once, and Morley was worried. She took Helen to see Dr. Keene for a checkup. I'm worried about her, she said. Dr. Keene called the next afternoon. There's nothing I can do, he said. I knew it, said Morley. What is it? Tell me. You could almost hear Dr. Keene shrugging over the phone. Your mother has the dwindles. The what, said Morley? The dwindles, said Dr. Keene. We all get them, eventually. Morley and Dave had talked about this for years. It was Dave's idea, not Morley's. It had to be Dave's idea. Morley would never have suggested it. But there it was. Helen shouldn't be living alone anymore, and Morley was driving to Helen's house to suggest that Helen move in with them. Morley had practiced what she was going to say over and over. She had practiced it out loud in the car on her way to work and on her way home. She had practiced it in front of the bathroom mirror. And she was practicing it now on her way to talk to her mother. It was a delicate matter. She didn't want to sound patronizing. Didn't want her mother to feel like she needed rescuing. Helen needed to maintain her dignity. But Morley had to be firm. She had practiced so much it all came out in a big awkward rush. It'd be good for all of us, said Morley. You could help out. With both Dave and I working, it's hard. We could use the help. Or I could. Helen reached out and patted Morley's arm. She didn't want to leave her house. But her daughter was practically begging for help. Morley obviously couldn't manage anymore. It was hardly a surprise. It was ridiculous what she was trying to do. Run a home and work full time? It was nonsense with a capital N. Helen said, all right, dear, I'll help out. It's what you do when you have children. Though you'd think by the time you were in your 80s, they'd leave you alone. The plan was she would rent her house so she could move back when things settled down, when Sam went to university. But she got an offer, and the agent said, you know, that's a good offer. So in the end, she sold. There's a room upstairs at the back of Dave and Morley's house that has its own bathroom. Used to be Stephanie's. They moved Stephanie's stuff into the attic loft, and Helen moved into the room at the back. Her bed and her bureau. It wasn't perfect, but there was nothing about this that was perfect. It was workable. I don't know, said Helen on the day before the move. This is making me nervous. They were at Helen's house packing the last of her stuff. I'm not sure if three generations are supposed to live together. It seems unnatural. Morley said, don't be nervous, Mom. It's going to be so much easier. Maybe for you, said Helen. She came on a Sunday. She always came on Sundays for dinner anyway, so it almost felt normal. They had dinner like they usually did, and she washed the dishes like she usually did. But then instead of getting into her coat and getting into the car so Dave could drive her home, Helen hung up her apron, and there was an awkward moment. The three of them standing in the kitchen, until Helen said, well, then, I think I'll go to my room. Sleep tight, said Morley. I'm going to make lunches for tomorrow. Recently on Sundays, after Helen leaves, it's become Morley's habit to rewash the dishes. Not all of them, but a lot of them. Helen's eyesight isn't what it used to be. She misses things. And so Helen went upstairs and Morley waited in the kitchen with her ear cocked, waiting to hear her mother climb safely into bed before she re-tackled the dishes. She was working on a wine glass when Helen reappeared. They both stared at the glass in Morley's hand, and then Morley followed Helen's gaze across the kitchen to the dish rack, which was full of dripping dishes. Neither of them said a word. Helen said, "I was wondering if there's any toothpaste." Morley said, "I'll get some." Monday morning was its usual rush and panic. Morley trying to make breakfast, Sam trying to wake up, or actually not. Dave wandering around looking for his backpack, his sunglasses, the blue folder with the leather thing, the smell of orange juice and burnt toast. And in the middle of it all, Helen wandering downstairs in her housecoat, oblivious. "Have you made the eggs yet?" she said. Sam looked up happily. "We're having eggs?" "No, no eggs," said Morley. "There's no time. Eat your toast." Helen stood in the middle of the kitchen and frowned, but she didn't say anything. It was clear to Helen that she was going to have to get up earlier from now on so she could make this family a decent breakfast. Morley sighed and dropped more bread into the toaster. Now she was going to have to get up earlier, early enough to make her mother eggs. "I made tea, Mom," said Morley. Mornings. They were four horses in one harness, pulling in different directions, stamping, bucking, and snorting. And then everything came to a crescendo. The horses whinnied and ran off, and just like that, in the snap of your fingers, the kitchen was like a racetrack at the end of the day, deserted and quiet. Just Helen. Just Helen sitting at the table with her pot of tea. Arthur the dog at her feet, maybe the cat somewhere, or maybe not. It's always hard to tell. "Oh, my," said Helen. First thing Helen did once everybody was gone was go upstairs and get a cardigan. It was freezing in that house. She found the thermostat in the hall and she turned it up. She'd turn it down before everyone came home. Then she wandered around and closed all the blinds. Helen didn't like the idea of people staring at her. After lunch, she napped in her room with the paper in her lap, and then she came downstairs and made herself another pot of tea and took it to the den to watch Coronation Street. The television, or what was left of it, the screen part of the television, was attached to the wall. Helen looked around the room. The rest of it, the guts of it, was nowhere to be seen. She stared at the screen carefully, searching for a knob so she could turn it on. Television didn't appear to have knobs. She ran her hand around the edge of the frame to see if she could feel a knob. All she could feel was nothing. She stepped back and scratched her head. She saw the remotes lying on the top of the bookshelf beside the screen. There were four of them. Helen's heart sank. Helen was afraid of remotes. She had read an informative article once in the Reader's Digest that remote controls were the most germ-ridden objects in hotel rooms. Helen didn't stay in hotels often, but the article had made a fierce impression. And she had vowed that if she ever found herself in a hotel room, she would never, never under any circumstances whatsoever touch a television remote. The Reader's Digest had explained that no one ever washed their remotes. Well, that was something she could do right now, wasn't it? But you'd have to be careful. At her age, something as simple as a cold virus could take her out in a matter of days. Helen went downstairs, found a pair of rubber gloves under the sink. She put the gloves on and went back and picked up the remotes. She was very careful to hold her breath while she was handling them. She dropped them 1, 2, 3, 4 into a plastic bag, and she held the bag away from her body as she carried it. It occurred to her that she had seen other remotes in the house as well. She might as well do them all at the same time. So she started at the top and worked her way methodically down to the kitchen. It took her 45 minutes. When she got downstairs and emptied her bag onto the kitchen table, there were 12 remotes lying there. Air conditioning remotes, heating remotes, stereo remotes. Holding her breath carefully, she lined them up carefully on the top shelf of the dishwasher. She stared at it proudly. But it seemed wrong to her to run the dishwasher for barely half a load. So she went back upstairs and came back with 2 computer keyboards, an infrared mouse, and Sam's iPod. She set the dishwasher to sterilize. And then she collapsed onto the largest chair in the living room. That was a good afternoon's work. Morley was last home that night. When she walked in through the back door, the house seemed unfamiliarly quiet and unusually dark. All the curtains were closed. It was hot, too. "I'm home," she called, but there was no response. She yawned. They were in the living room, all of them, sound asleep. Helen in her chair with her legs stretched in front of her and her head drooped on her chest. Dave curled up on the couch and Sam sprawled on the living room floor. Morley almost sat down with them. "Give your head a shake," she said. And instead, she turned down the thermostat and started preparing dinner. First thing she did was open the dishwasher. That woke them. The thing with the remotes was a bad beginning. Instead of searching out chores, Helen began to spend her time like she did at home, doing crosswords and talking on the phone to friends. In the afternoons, after her nap, she went for walks around the neighborhood. She didn't say anything, and she wouldn't have seen it this way herself, but those walks were small acts of defiance. Helen was asserting herself. She was telling her daughter that she didn't want to be a housekeeper. Of course, that's not the way Morley interpreted it. "I saw your mother again this afternoon," said Mary Turlington. "She seemed to be lost." The idea of her mother walking aimlessly around the neighborhood scared Morley. "Mom," said Morley, "where were you this afternoon?" Helen hadn't been paying any attention. She had just walked for 15 or 20 minutes and then come back. "I have no idea," said Helen. Oh, dear, thought Morley. Helen was enjoying her walks, but she found that she tired easily. One afternoon, when she ventured a little far, she flagged a taxi to take her home. She told the driver that she was trying to learn her new neighborhood and asked how much it would cost to drive around for a while. She got lucky. The driver was a guy from Somalia who felt guilty about leaving his mother when he came to Canada. He didn't charge Helen, and then he arranged to pick her up the next afternoon. And so every afternoon, when the taxi business was quiet, they drove around the neighborhood, telling each other their problems. It was Dave's friend Kenny Wong who spotted her. "See," said Kenny the next afternoon, "very same time every day. They just seem to drive around in circles." Morley became convinced her mother was losing it, not to mention a fortune on taxis. Only thing she could think of doing to keep her at home was to keep her busy. She drew up a new list of chores. "These are things you could do to help," she said. They would really help out. It was lunch, and they were sitting at the kitchen table. Helen's heart was sinking as she ran her finger down the list. There was so much on it. She felt overwhelmed. "I wish she would let me relax," said Helen to her friend Ruth. "I wish I could just take it easy. I've earned it." "She doesn't seem to be able to relax," said Morley to Dave. "I wish she could relax. She's earned it." But they didn't say these things to each other. "You should move to my retirement community," said Ruth to Helen. I have my own place, and they have dinner in the dining room if I want." "She needs me," said Helen. It's hard for her. The kids, her job, David. When she was a girl, Morley used to love to watch her mother iron. The hiss of the steam, the spray of the water, and the peaceful perfection of the folded piles. When she thought of her mother, she always thought of ironing. So she added ironing to the list. And so Helen started ironing too. And one morning, Sam stood in his bedroom calling for his mother. "My jeans are weird," he said. The jeans were hanging stiffly from his hips. There was a sharp crease running down the middle of each leg. "I can't bend my legs," said Sam. Helen was trying her best, God knows. "I really want to help," said Helen to Ruth one afternoon on the phone, "but honestly, who irons these days?" Ruth said there was a laundry service available at her retirement residence and that she had a cleaner come in every week to do her floors and bathroom. There were bridge nights and a movie night and community dinner every night of the week if you wanted it. Helen sighed and looked at the basket of socks waiting to be sorted. What on earth was her daughter's family doing with so many socks? In the end, she stayed 4 months. All things considered, it ended well. Better, really, than anyone could have hoped. One afternoon, Helen looked at Morley and said, "We need to talk. My friend Ruth is lonely." "She needs my help. I think I should move in with her." Morley sat up straight. "It'll be difficult," said Morley, measuring her words carefully. "It'll be difficult without you." "Well, that's obvious," said Helen. "What?" said Morley. Helen reached out and put her hand on her daughter's arm. You do a good job, sweetie," she said. And so she went. And Morley, who had spent her life leaving her mother, for the first time had to watch her mother leave her. "She seems happy," she said to Dave after another Sunday dinner, after he drove her back to her new place. "Yes," he said, "it surprises me." "Well, maybe at her age, it's not so much where you are," said Morley. "It's how you got there." "She got there on her own." Dave said, as long as you're still covering ground, I guess. Maybe that's enough." "Maybe," said Morley. "Maybe that's all of it." She was rewashing the dinner dishes. He was standing by the door. She turned and looked at him. "We've covered ground," she said. It wasn't clear to Dave if she was asking a question or making a statement. "Yes," he said, "we have, and we have more to cover yet." They looked at each other for the longest moment. "That too," she said, and she turned back to the dishes. Thank you. Well, that's about all the time we have for today's show. Before we go, I want to thank our special musical guest, Craig Cardiff. Thanks also this week to Andrew Curry, Ron Skinner, Bill Herault, and Frank Finistori for the technical assistance. David Amers, the founding producer of the Vinyl Cafe. Louise Curtis is the production assistant. Julie Penner is the music producer. Meg Masters is the long-suffering story editor. The Vinyl Cafe is produced by Jess Milton. I'm Stuart McLean in Bracebridge, Ontario, and we're going to let Craig sing us out now. So long for now. Thanks.
People go and people leave, make some people cry, make some people drink. When people go and when people leave, it's the saddest thing. When people go, is it like they're asleep? Lost to the world in a longish dream, like when boats at sea never come back. Is it like that? I think it's gonna be another long night. I think it's gonna be another long night. When people go, when people leave, make some people cry, make some people drink. When people go and when people leave, it's the saddest thing. When people go, is it like they're asleep? Lost to the world in a longish dream. All I bought to see and never come back. Is it like that? Sleepy in the air, broken in the heart. There's no business here. It's all art until it's far behind. And it all comes back when people go. It's so sad, so sad, so sad. It's so sad, so sad, so sad.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.